Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a lawsuit filed today in federal court by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against the National Security Agency to stop it spying on American citizens. Cindy Cohn, the legal director and general counsel of the Electronic Freedom Foundation, joins us to discuss the legal challenges ahead to stop what the plaintiffs describe as an illegal and unconstitutional program of dragnet electronic surveillance. Then we'll speak with Gary Young, a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian, whose recent article in The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This, has gained international attention. With appeals for calm in the wake of such an unjust verdict, Gary Young asks, as the father of a black child, how he and his child can feel calm and whether the only option now for black teens who venture out of their homes is to be armed like George Zimmerman. Then finally, following a recent report by the UN that China's population will shrink, India's will plateau, but Africa's will explode, we will speak with John Bongaerts, Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Population Council, an international nonprofit that studies world population. We will look into Africa's lost decade in birth control and how the world's increasingly strained water and land resources will be able to support an estimated 9.6 billion people by 2050. And joining us now is Cindy Cohn, who is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. The Electronic Frontier Foundation today in federal court in San Francisco filed a lawsuit against the National Security Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cindy Cohn.
Thank you.
And this unusual coalition that you represent in your lawsuit, they are environmentalists, human rights activists, church leaders, gun rights advocates. They have joined you in the suit that you filed today. So you've got Greenpeace, Human Rights Watch, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and CalGuns Foundation. So what is the broad interest here that you've put together? And, of course, the other question is exactly what are you suing the National Security Agency over?
Well, so the focus of the case is the right of association under the First Amendment. The First Amendment is important to groups from across this political spectrum that focus on various different issues. One of the beauties of the First Amendment is it doesn't really care what your viewpoint is. It protects your right to say it here in the United States of America. And it also protects your right to associate with others in order to say things, to form and join groups like my clients, like Human Rights Watch, like People for the American Way, like California, the California Gun Foundation, CalGuns. And so we brought this group of folks together because we think that the National Security Agency's wholesale bulk collection of everybody's telephone records violates the right of association of these associations, their members, and the other people that associate with them. The case arises out of the now admitted program by the National Security Agency to collect everybody's telephone records. They're collecting all of your calls 24 hours, 7 days a week, and they're keeping them for up to 5 years. We're trying to stop this. We think it's unconstitutional and illegal, and we're hopeful that this case will help the courts understand what's at stake in these cases. The government claims that it's just metadata. But just metadata does reveal who you associate with, when, and how often, and for how long. And the First Amendment has a lot to say about that.
Well, so does the Fourth Amendment, surely.
Sure it does. And we certainly raised the Fourth Amendment in this case as well. We also raised the Fifth Amendment right to due process. And we sought the return of the property under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So we're not just relying on the First Amendment, but I think that the debate around the NSA spying so far in this country has really focused on the Fourth Amendment, the right to privacy, and the reasonable expectation of privacy that people have in their communications. And I certainly believe strongly in that, and it's part of this case and the earlier case we brought. But we wanted, the reason we brought this case on behalf of associations is we wanted to broaden the conversation a bit. It's not just the Fourth Amendment that has something to say here. It's the First Amendment and, frankly, the Fifth Amendment as well.
Well, I guess the Fifth Amendment is applicable in as much as there's so much data now, both that the government collects and that private industry like Google and Facebook collects on individuals. that you could argue that your right not to incriminate yourself has been violated.
Well, it's possible, but that's not the claim that we're making here. That's a much harder claim to make. The Fifth Amendment does a bunch of things, but the main thing it does is it requires due process of law before your rights can be taken away. And the claim that we've raised here talks about two things. First, it talks about your right to informational privacy and the need for government to make some kind of specific showing that you may have violated the law before it gets to violate your informational privacy rights here, and that hasn't been met. And the second way the Fifth Amendment comes into play is that, you know, we have a process that the due process requires that the people be able to know what the laws are. That they know what the standards are, when the law government can have access to their communications, and that those rules be clear, understandable to the public, and very easy for law enforcement to follow, clear to law enforcement. And our argument is that by developing a whole body of secret law around what it's doing, the government has violated the due process rights of Americans to frankly know what the law is.
Well, of course, the government has said they've insisted that the surveillance revelations about these surveillance programs would cause grave national security problems. And they've talked about how in the Bradley Manning case, how just putting that material out on the Internet provided al-Qaeda with advantages or intelligence simply because they are capable of looking using the Internet. But what happened to President Obama's call for a national debate that's followed the Snowden revelations here? I don't get the impression that we are having a national debate, or at least that it's not a two-way street.
Well, it doesn't appear that we're having a national debate, and we're hopeful that this case can help ignite this. Look, the fastest way for the spying to stop is for the government to just stop doing it. You know, we're going to engage in the litigation. We're hopeful that the courts will side with us, but that's certainly a much slower road than actually us having a national conversation and the government deciding as a result of this that it doesn't want to continue with this anymore, that it's too unpopular and that the American people don't want it. So we're hopeful that this can be part of the conversation. I also want to differentiate what we're suing over here from the Manning example in a really important way. You know, the telephone records collection program that we're suing over here in this case has been admitted by the government. The complaint has attached to it a press release from the Director of National Intelligence admitting that this is what they're doing, that they are collecting wholesale the records of millions of Americans. So the central thing that we want the courts to decide about is public. The government's admitted it now. After denying it for years and years and years, they've stymied us in the courts in other cases by trying to claim secrecy around this. But what's different today and what we hope will make this case able to move more quickly is that we're suing over what the government has admitted. And I think that makes it very different than some of the other national security cases and, frankly, puts this case in a very different posture than where we were when we started our Juul versus NSA case in 2006, where we had some governmental admissions and we had a lot of evidence, but we didn't have what we have now, which is the Director of National Intelligence saying, yes, we are doing this.
Again, I'm speaking with Cindy Cohn, who is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. Today in federal court in San Francisco, the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit against the National Security Agency. I spoke earlier with Mark Rotenberg of the EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington, D.C., and they've gone ahead and petitioned the Supreme Court to, in fact, invalidate what the National Security Agency is doing through the authorization of the FISA court, which the authorization comes under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And that's sort of the loophole, if you will, that they're driving a Mack truck through. And that the notion is that this is an abuse of the Patriot Act because it says that you can use the government can look for information relating to an ongoing criminal complaint or investigation. So this petition to the Supreme Court apparently is making the simple argument that how can data on every American be a part of an ongoing investigation? That basically means that every American is a terrorist suspect, and that just doesn't hold water. So what's your understanding about where that stands, and how do you feel about that route?
Well, look, I think anybody who can stop the spying is a hero, and I appreciate the EPIC's effort to kind of go right to the Supreme Court. You know, it's procedurally difficult to do that. The court doesn't have to take the case, and but I think it's a brave effort, and I'm glad that they're doing it. We're going to try our ways. I mean, I think all people who are concerned about the spying are you know, across the country are racking their brains trying to figure out the best way to go forward to try to stop the spying. And, you know, I view EPIC as one of, you know, our friends in this fight. So they've tried their way, and we're trying our way. And whoever gets to stop the spying first is, you know, that's great. You know, I think we should let a thousand flowers bloom for ways to try to stop the spying.
Right.
We also have a claim under Section 215 in our case as well, making the same argument. You know, it can't possibly be the case that the wholesale collection of everybody's telephone records is I don't actually think it's what the statute says. I mean, frankly, Congress didn't authorize the wholesale surveillance of the entire country. You don't remember any political debate on that at the time of the Patriot Act. They said they were doing something different. The statute appears to be doing something different, something much more targeted. And the government's interpretation of the statute to let it do this, I think, is just wrong and should be declared wrong by the courts. Whether that's the Supreme Court in the first instance or our case, frankly, I don't care. I think the sooner we can stop the spying, the better.
And given that you're near Silicon Valley, as Cindy Cohn, the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel, what's your understanding of where things stand with these big companies, particularly Verizon and AT&T, but in terms of the Internet, a number of big companies are also being ordered through the FISA court to supply this metadata. Yahoo apparently is resisting and asking the government to unseal a 2008 case that ordered the firm to turn over customer data. Where does that stand? I mean, my understanding is that the government actually pays these companies. They don't do it out of charity or patriotism. They do it because they're getting paid to do it.
Well, there's a couple different programs kind of involved here. So the Section 215 programs involve the telecommunications company. That's Verizon and AT&T, the phone companies. And it appears that at least as of the last few years, it's not clear how long. So the government has put different hats over the same behavior over the years since 2001. But it appears that at least for the last few years, the phone company program, the Section 215 program, has been pursuant to FISA court rulings, and so the companies are responding to FISA court rulings. The other program, the one involving the Internet companies, Microsoft and Google and some of these other companies, is the government claims its authority under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. That has a different legal justification. I think it's just as full of holes as the Section 215 thing. Our case hasn't taken, we haven't taken that on yet, but I wouldn't rule that out in the future. And it's not clear whether there are court orders for the 702 program or not. Microsoft, in its latest response to the government, seems to indicate that there's a FISA court order there too, but it's hard to know. I mean, honestly, all of this really indicates that we need the government to come clean with us about when is it getting access to our communications records, the domestic communications and communications records of millions of ordinary Americans. Like, Americans deserve to know if the government's getting bulk access to their communications. So, you know, based on what's been kind of leaked so far and some of the things that the government's admitted, there appear to be two different programs, one just aimed at phone records, another aimed at Internet communications. The claim about Internet communications is that they're only targeting foreigners, and that they've got some internal process where they're 51% sure that people are foreigners, and then they get to look at their communications. It's all very hazy. I think the legal justification for that is, you know, is also secret, and frankly, it's not believable that they have a real legal justification for that would survive serious scrutiny by a real court as opposed to a secret one-sided court. So I think we're still learning. I'm sorry that's a long-winded answer, but I think we're still learning what's going on with the Internet companies, and I'm not sure we're done figuring this out. But I suspect there will be litigation arising from that as well at some point in the future.
Well, what we do know, I've talked to Cindy Cohn, to a number of former NSA whistleblowers, Thomas Drake and William Binney, who blew the whistle on vastly expensive, $8 billion worth of taxpayer money going into these complicated algorithms that they're developing to mine data. And they, in fact, in Drake's case, he got booted out and held at gunpoint and charged as a spy for trying to save the taxpayer $8 billion. So we don't quite know how much of what the NSA is doing is a kind of form of right-wing welfare or some kind of corporate boondoggle because of the massive privatization of intelligence that's happened subsequent to 9/11. But what we do know is that a vast complex is being built up in Utah to store this data. And I don't think you have to be Einstein to put two and two together that this all this metadata is going to be stored until such times as maybe these algorithms, you know, work. I mean, the idea, I'm not sure that it's technically possible to come up with an algorithm that predicts the future, but apparently the NSA thinks that they're working on it, you know. So is that what's going on here?
Well, it's hard to know, but I do agree with you that the development of the Utah facility with such huge capability for storing information provides a lot of support for what Mr. Drake and Mr. Binney and J. Kirk Wiebe have been saying about what the NSA is doing. Those three men are all witnesses and have filed declarations in my earlier NSA case, Juul versus NSA, along with Mark Klein, an AT&T whistleblower who drew attention to the facility in the AT&T building here in Folsom Street in San Francisco, where copies of all internet traffic are being sent to the NSA's control. So, you know, the pieces are starting to fall into place. I think it's very clear that the government is intending on making copies of a tremendous amount of our communications and communications records, and then having the ability to search through it later, to have kind of a time machine where they can search through it later in the event that they have need to figure out, you know, who we talked to in the past, how often we talked to them, and when and where. So, you know, I think the pieces are all starting to fall into place. The phone records program and the internet metadata program, the PRISM project that is in the slides. The slides also reveal the fiber optic splitter information that Mr. Klein testified about. Now, they're all falling into place as pieces of a much bigger set of programs to spy on Americans in America. And I think it's time for the American people to be able to have a voice in that and to put a stop to it.
Well, just in closing, Cindy Cohn, in terms of the Edward Snowden, who first revealed this PRISM program and suggested that sitting at his desk, he could tap into what the President of the United States was communicating, which, of course, was subsequently denied. But given now that Edward Snowden is seeking refuge and asylum in a country that is not famous for its human rights and civil rights, not to mention its internet laws, do you think that one can separate the message from the messenger here, if indeed the messenger is tainted?
Absolutely. The information that we're suing over today has been admitted by the U.S. government. The Director of National Intelligence has admitted that this is true. They've also issued a whole bunch of other admissions about things that Mr. Snowden presented. So to me, at that point, Mr. Snowden isn't important to the conversation at all. Our government has admitted that it's doing these things. And the question for the American people is, do we think that's okay? Is it constitutional, and is it subject to the laws and the rule of law? I think at that point, Mr. Snowden's role in this shouldn't be the central focus. And indeed, I think to the extent that the media is paying attention to the particularities of whether Mr. Snowden is a nice guy or not a nice guy, they're playing into a game that is not really to the benefit of the American people. The American people need to stop and think about the surveillance that's now been admitted by their government and indicated by the evidence shown. And getting caught up in a personality game about Mr. Snowden is frankly not what Mr. Snowden wanted. He was very clear about this, that this was not about him, and it was about the information he was bringing forward. And frankly, I think it does a disservice to the country.
Well, Cindy Cohn, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Cindy Cohn, who's legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 Most Influential Lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. And today, the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit in federal court in San Francisco against the National Security Agency. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the open season on black boys after the Zimmerman verdict. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gary Young, a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian. He's based in the United States, and he writes a monthly column for The Nation called Beneath the Radar. His book, No Place Like Home, in which he retraced the route of the civil rights freedom riders, was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award in 1999. Gary Young also has made several radio and television documentaries on subjects ranging from the Tea Party movement to hip-hop culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Young.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian.
And Gary, I've been trying to talk to prominent lawyers, prosecutors, defense people, people down in Florida, people who understand the Stand Your Ground law and its genesis through ALEC and the NRA, etc. And what I find extraordinary about this case is that the entire narrative that the defense of George Zimmerman based their defense on is entirely speculative. In other words, there was no witness to what actually happened prior to Trayvon Martin being killed and when he was killed. However, the narrative before that happened is in fact on the record and is unassailable, and that is a 911 call where he was told by the police dispatcher to stay in his car and not to pursue this person who he considered to be a felon. He was clearly chafing at the bit to get some justice in his mind. So how do you explain that disconnect, that that part of the case was inadmissible in the trial?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I find most peculiar, because the tussle, the fight between Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin is really a case of he said and he's dead, because one of the people is dead already. That's why we have, you know, the trial that we do. So we only have Zimmerman's account and then some kind of grainy audio footage and so on. But what we know up until that point is that Zimmerman chased Trayvon. We know that. We know that because it's in the 911 calls, and we know that because Zimmerman is basically doesn't dispute that fact, and so that begs the question: when does Trayvon get to stand his ground? On what ground can he defend himself? That what I can't understand about the way this case is framed in terms of self-defense is how Trayvon Martin gets home that night without being killed. That what is he supposed to do? Now, we don't know, as you say, speculation, what happens between him and Zimmerman. But let's just take Zimmerman's account, his account. According to his account, Zimmerman's account, he chases Trayvon. He follows him, then he gives chase. Trayvon fights back, gets the better of him, at which point he shoots him. So if he had not chased him, as the dispatcher suggested that he shouldn't, if he had not been suspicious of him, and we know that there were no ground for him being suspicious of him, there is no suggestion that Trayvon was in fact committing any crime, then Craigland would be alive and Zimmerman would be going about his business. Now, what one lawyer from Florida said to me yesterday was, but following somebody is not a crime. Well, there are many things that aren't particularly intelligent that are not a crime, and this is one of them. And if you follow someone and you are the cause of an altercation, it beggars belief to me. How then that becomes a question of self-defense?
And how does one get one's head around the idea that all of the 911 call and all of the time frame and the activities and the motives of George Zimmerman prior to the altercation, for which there was no witnesses, all of that was inadmissible, particularly the 911 call, which seems to clearly establish his intent and his prejudice against somebody that he thinks is a menace to society?
I really can't explain that. I can't explain it legally in terms of the case. What I do believe, however, is that if we look at this systemically as opposed to systematically, I do not believe that George Zimmerman woke up that day and said, I'm going to shoot a black kid. I don't believe that. But systemically, we do live in a society where, and we know this from the kind of accounts of stop and frisk in Manhattan and elsewhere, where particularly young black men, by their very presence, are suspicious, and that the authorities believe they have, therefore, the right to stop them on the grounds of them being there, and that this is, on some level, not seen as being a particularly peculiar thing that Zimmerman, as an individual, not as a representative of the state, would have the right and the authority to stop Trayvon and chase him and demand some kind of authentication for why he should be there.
Again, I'm speaking with Gary Young, who is a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian. He's based in the United States, and he also writes a monthly column for The Nation called Beneath the Radar. He has an article at The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This. And, Gary, we've had some violence here in Los Angeles, and the Crenshaw District, and briefly in the Baldwin Hills area. The Black Riders Liberation Party, which is a kind of neo-Black Panther organization, apparently were a part of this, chanting no justice, no peace. But by and large, there's been very little outbreaks and demonstrations of the very real anger that's festering here in the African-American community in the United States and also in the white community. I don't believe that – I think across the board people are outraged and quite puzzled by what has happened in Florida, although – we have a history of weird things in Florida like hanging chads and butterfly ballots, etc. But this definitely takes it to another level. What's your reaction to the outbreak of violence here in Los Angeles, albeit not on a great scale?
Well, I mean, here's the difference between, I think it was Mr. Crump, the family lawyer of the Trayvon Martins, who compared Trayvon Martin to Emmett Till, the young black a kid from Chicago who was murdered in Mississippi, and Medgar Evers, who was also shot dead in Mississippi by Barrow and Dilla Beckwith in 1963. And he said Trayvon Martin's name will go down in history like theirs. But there's one key difference between now and the 50s and the 60s, which was then there was a civil rights movement. There was a mass movement that was organized and could channel the frustration and the anger to very definite aims and goals in terms of getting rid of codified segregation and moves towards equality. We don't really have that now. We do. There are organizations like the NAACP, which is meeting over this week, and there are individuals. But we don't have a movement. And therefore, I think, you know, it's entirely predictable that there will be these. There have been a number of kind of large peaceful demonstrations, and most demonstrations have been peaceful. But there will be these kind of outbreaks of violence because people are extremely frustrated, and there is a sense that the law is not there to protect them, and therefore there is no sense in kind of in respecting it. I mean, this takes place among a kind of series of very kind of contradictory shifts. You know, we have a black president. We also have a black community that has been absolutely hammered economically, and which is much more, you know, where people are more likely to, particularly young men, are more likely to go to jail than go to college. And so there is a frustration, is a tinderbox is there. And a case like this, I mean, when the Watts riots broke out in L.A., it was over a traffic stop. When the Detroit riots broke out in 67, I think, it was over the raid of a kind of late-night drinking den. Well, this is a far more resonant kind of infraction than that. And on the subject of Obama, it's telling what we have as a kind of limits of kind of the benefits of a black president in terms of a black community. So in the beginning, when Trayvon Martin case was first being discussed last year, he says, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. And now he says, you know, we're a nation of laws, and which is beyond doubt. The question is, who do those laws serve, and what is the central purpose of those laws? Being a nation of laws is very different to being a nation of justice. So you have an entirely different response as the head of state, and so you have someone who says, I could be Trayvon's dad, but then responds not as Trayvon's dad. I'm sure Trayvon's dad is not saying, oh, well, we're a nation of laws and these things must be respected. As the kind of national arbiter of calm and peace. And it's difficult to see how there can be calm when a boy can be shot dead on his way home from a store, minding his own business, and nobody pays a price legally.
And Gary Young, in your article at The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This, you talk about the parents of black boys not likely to be feeling calm, parents of black men not likely to feel calm, children with black fathers are not likely to feel calm. I guess in a way here, what's required is for the rest of America to start feeling some empathy. I mean, all parents surely should recognize what it must feel like that if your teenage kid goes out the door, they may not come back simply because they look like who they are.
Well, that's right. I think that politically there was a real problem here. And even in Obama's statement that if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon, you can't help thinking, well, is that what it takes? Do we not have the power of imagination to understand that even if your child does not look like Trayvon, that the loss of your child in such circumstances would be of immense concern if the person who shot him walked free for 44 days? That identification is fine. And, for example, I am the father of a black son, and I do feel this particularly keenly, but I don't think I need to have those attributes in order to understand this injustice. We're all human, and we all have the power of intellect. And those two things, I think, should suffice for people to understand. Because if we understand this case in the context of the criminal justice system and stop and frisk and so on, then what we have is a system of policing and of jurisprudence that does not seem to be set up in order to protect non-white people's interests. And a system that is thus set up does not really serve anybody. It's not in anybody's interest to have a large section of the American population feeling that they are cast beyond the law. That would be a very reasonable conclusion to looking at the results of this case and of the other ways in which the judicial system operates.
Well, just in closing, Gary Young, do you think this is likely to revive the kind of moribund gun control debate, which has obviously been dominated by the NRA and in spite of extraordinary, brutal massacres of young children and the repetitive nature of these massacres that go on throughout the country and the mass killings in the sense that there's almost a competition to kill as many people in the shortest period of time with the most powerful weapons. And we have the most well-armed criminals in this country, and these well-armed criminals are now in Florida are now taking advantage of the Stand Your Ground law. So if you combine the Stand Your Ground law with the concealed carry law, all of which have been pushed by both ALEC and the NRA, you are really getting back to a kind of Dodge City frontier mentality and vigilante justice. And you would think that this case, where all of that is writ large, would be provoking some kind of debate beyond the very justified conversation we've had about race relations.
You would hope so, although I fear not. It seems as though America only really responds to issues of gun control or issues of guns when large numbers of people are killed at the same time, and usually when a significant number of them are white, unfortunately. And that those conversations then, like this, or those debates that are filtered through race, unfortunately, end up being understood as sui generis, just kind of understood with, you know, within their own context. I think there is a very kind of a very real debate to be had. I'm British, and in general, British people don't carry guns. The police generally don't carry guns, and so while in many ways I would argue that Britain is a more violent country, you're much more likely to get punched in the face by a drunk person in many kind of market terms than you would in America, it's less deadly. And that, to me, seems to be a kind of lesson that's never quite learned. There are two ways in which you could go with the Trayvon Martin case when you look at the nature of it. One is, if Zimmerman had not been armed, Trayvon Martin would still be alive, even if he'd had that fight. The second is that if Trayvon Martin had been armed, then he may have shot Zimmerman. And that one logical conclusion to this is that, and I've seen this certainly on my Facebook page, well, maybe it's time that, you know, we arm more young black men. Maybe that's the only way that he gets home alive. This is a terrible conclusion. And yet, there is a morbid logic to it.
Well, Gary Young, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Young, who's a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian. He's based in the United States and writes a monthly column for The Nation called Beneath the Radar. His book, No Place Like Home, in which he retraced the route of the civil rights freedom riders, was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award in 1999. And he has an article at The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the population explosion in Africa.
All the families and the students all confused and party. We've been through each other's arms. It's murder. No absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn. Overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. Shell shell like a bell and run the blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged, and in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs, and his soul.
Enwa kofomuni, enwa novyomuni, enwa ehlomuni, enwa dadamuni.
Ye kumlano soma.
Ye kumlano se, kumlano se.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Bongartz, who is the Vice President and Distinguished Scholar of the Population Council, an international nonprofit that studies world population. He focuses on fertility, population, environmental relationships, the demographic impact of AIDS, population aging, and population policy options in the developing world. His research has laid the foundation for effective population forecasts that galvanized population policy in several countries, including China and developing nations in sub-Saharan Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Bongartz.
Thank you.
And last week, in advance of World Population Day, the United Nations issued a report that's quite alarming about how the population in Africa is going to explode. It's going to quadruple by the end of the century, and that Nigeria is on track to surpass the United States as the world's third most populous country by 2050, and it will, by the end of the century, it will rival the population of China. So is this caught people by surprise, this explosion of population in Africa?
Well, to some extent, yes. The revisions that the UN made were not expected, but the reality is that we now have in Africa much higher fertility than we expected to have. And the UN and most other demographers have assumed that Africa would see declining fertility just the way we've seen it in the past in Latin America and Asia. And in Latin America and Asia, today, women on average have two or two and a half children each, on average. In Africa, however, fertility decline began, and that was, of course, good news, but it has stalled, and that was a big surprise. And today, in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, women on average have over five children each. And that is a number that, together with the low death rates, means very rapid population growth. And as you mentioned, the population of Africa is less than a billion today and expected to grow to 4 billion. And that is not good news for Africans.
And the country that I mentioned that whose population is exploding, Nigeria, in Nigeria, 10% of married women of childbearing years take birth control.
Right.
Compared to 72% here in the United States. So you have referred to a lost decade of family planning in Africa. Can you explain that?
Well, if we go back for a moment to the early 1990s, and you have to remember that at that time the AIDS epidemic started and appeared to be going so fast that some epidemiologists predicted that population growth in Africa would be wiped out. So African governments and the international community said, wait a minute, if AIDS epidemic is going to be have such a huge impact, then what's the point of trying to bring fertility down? Because we'll need extra births to prevent population decline. And that was not an unreasonable position at the time. But the result of that was that family planning funding dropped sharply, and programs addressing the AIDS epidemic were growing at a very rapid clip. It turns out that the AIDS epidemic has now peaked and has only had a minor impact on population growth. So the death rates from AIDS is declining, and the population growth rate is as high as ever today. And that was not expected. And that's the first point. The second point is that the fertility declines that were expected based on the conventional trends in other countries stalled. So in Kenya, for example, the birth rate was about 8 births per woman in the 60s and 70s. It declined to about 5, so everybody said, ah, that's good news. Kenya will eventually get down to 2 children per woman, as is the case in Asia. But instead, Kenya has now had a birth rate of near 5 births per woman for the last decade and a half, and that is a surprise. So the combined effect of a AIDS epidemic that has turned out to have a smaller effect on population growth than expected, and the birth rate that has not declined as rapidly as expected, means that the UN and other demographers have had to revise their growth rates. More births and fewer deaths means more growth. And that is now reflected in the new and very substantially upward revised the projections of the United Nations for Africa.
Now, we've talked about how Nigeria is exploding and will equal or surpass the population of the United States by 2050. What's interesting about the UN's population study that just was released is that China will begin to shrink and India will plateau. So the two countries that most demographers have always said were somewhat out of control in terms of their population, that does not appear to be the case. China will start to reverse and India will plateau.
That's correct. India is, the growth rate is now declining, which means it's still increasing, but at a slower pace than before. China, of course, has had a one-child policy for a number of years, and that is now leading to the end of population growth. But the most important distinction between China, India, and many other Asian countries is that the governments of these countries have actually said we would like to have slower population growth. And to achieve that, they have implemented so-called family planning programs, which provide contraception to women of reproductive age. Now, of course, in China, that led to a coercive policy, but in India, it's essentially a voluntary program, and the same is true in Asia, Bangladesh, Thailand, and all the other countries. And by providing access to contraception, women can achieve the decline in fertility they desire. In most countries, 10, 20, 30, 30% of births are unwanted. So if you provide contraception to these women, then they can avoid these unintended pregnancies. That means that the women are better off, so they have smaller families and they can take care of the children better. Society is better off because population growth is slower. Now, the key issue is that in Africa, most governments have not put family planning or population growth at the top of their priority agenda. That's beginning to change in a few countries, but certainly in Nigeria that is the case. And this is why in Nigeria we still have so high fertility and so rapid population growth. But it's true in many other countries in Africa. The government simply doesn't think this is high priority. There are, as I said, exceptions. And I'm pointing, for example, to Rwanda and Ethiopia. Once the government decides that this is an issue that should be paid attention to, they provide services to not only urban but also rural families and villages, you get very quick adoption of contraception. In Rwanda, contraceptive use has almost doubled in 5 years because of the extra services that were provided by the government. So the lesson here is that if more governments in throughout Africa pay attention to this issue, we can actually slow population growth, and it can be done in a voluntary way. It does not require coercion of any kind.
Well, what about the role, for example, of some of the fundamentalist churches here in the United States that are very much against abortion? And then in particular, the role of the Catholic Church. I recall it wasn't so long ago that the previous Pope made a remark that condoms weren't effective against AIDS. And then he had to retract that or at least revise that remark. So when you talk about how there was an expectation that AIDS would reduce the population of Africa and it didn't turn out to be as bad as people projected and now the population's exploding, you've got people like yourself that are crunching the numbers. Then you've got people like Bill and Melinda Gates and other foundations that are trying to deal with the problems. Mm-hmm. But then you've got these religious groups out there that seem to be on a different planet.
You're right, and I think it's a very unfortunate. The Catholic Church and conservative institutions around the world, not only Catholic but also Islamic, have opposed improving the role and status of women, and they're not in favor of contraception or abortion. Now, abortion is practiced in practically every population around the world. Where it is illegal, you end up with a lot of unsafe abortions, and that, of course, ends up killing many women. In addition, the Catholic Church is against what they call artificial contraception, and that means that people who obey the Church would have likely have many unwanted pregnancies. Now, fortunately, I should say that the Church's influence on the Catholics, particularly in, say, Latin America, has been minimal. If you look at Catholic countries and you compare the fertility rates of Catholics with other religious, you see very little difference in fertility. So basically, Catholic families pay not that much attention to what the Church says. But, and this is very important, the Catholic Church has an influence on policymakers, on the government, on international organizations. For example, the Vatican is a vigorous opponent of these issues in international fora, and that has slowed down the international movement to help women who want to practice contraception. So that has been an obstacle, and this is one of the reasons that contributed to the decline in family planning in the 1990s and early 2000s. Now, fortunately, as you just pointed out, the international community is coming back now, and one very good example of that is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has massively increased their support for family planning. Last year, there was an international conference in London where many governments came and donors came together saying family planning should be on the top of the global agenda. So we're now seeing a very substantial increase in attention, political commitment, and funding to family planning, which I think is way overdue. But it takes time for these investments to pay off. So it will take years before we actually see a big impact.
And John Bongartz, again, Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Population Council. Just to focus what you just said, the world's population is on track to reach 9.6 billion by mid-century and 11 billion by 2100, which is 700 million more than was projected 2 years ago. So, you know, I've talked to biologists and say that the optimum population for the planet in terms of protecting biodiversity and for the health of the planet is 1 billion people. So we're way past that. I mean, you know, but at what point is enough enough?
Well, I'm not sure that 1 billion is the right number, and I don't think there is an exact number that you can say here is where we get into a disaster and below that we're okay. Basically, I would say every billion we add to the planet makes life more difficult for everybody else. So right now we're a little over 7 billion, and that's hard enough. We go to 8 or 9, we still can manage that. When we get to 10 or 11, it will become more and more difficult. The environment will be hurt. Food prices and energy prices will rise. And anything that we need from the environment will become more costly. And that, of course, is okay for most people living in the U.S. If we have to pay a little bit more for food or a little bit more for gasoline, it's not going to change our standards of living. But if the cost of food and energy goes up, it will badly hurt the poorest, and particularly the poorest in the poorest countries. And that's already happening. We've seen the massive increases in the price of food on the world market in the last few years. Energy prices have risen too. And this is very bad news for the poor around the world.
Well, so far we've been focusing on Africa and particularly on sub-Saharan Africa. But I was just speaking the other day to a politician from Egypt who mentioned that every 10 months in Egypt, a million more people are added to the population. And we know that Egypt is one of the most resource-thin countries on the planet. It's so much of it depends upon the waters of the Nile River. And now we learn that in Ethiopia, they're planning on building dams that's going to affect the water flow of the Nile River. So if you have the lifeline of Egypt threatened at one end and every 10 months a million new Egyptians being born, already with this massive youth unemployment that they have, they're the kids that are taking to the streets demanding democracy, you know, that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
Yes, I think this is going to be very difficult. Wars over resources we've had in the past, but I think they will become much more serious in the future. You just mentioned the Nile and Ethiopia versus Egypt. Now, Ethiopia, of course, is growing very fast as well. They're growing by a million, and they have poorer, the population of Ethiopia is poorer than in Egypt. So the Ethiopians say, well, this is our water, we're going to use it for our farmers. And the Egyptians say, no, we've always had it. So this is clearly a conflict in the making, but there are quite a few other places on the planet where we have similar problems. Bangladesh and India and countries around the Tibetan Plateau are all depending on the water and the ice caps there. So some of the largest rivers of the world come from that Tibetan Plateau. They flow into China, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan. And they all want more water, which is not going to be available. So China is damming up rivers that are needed to feed and feed countries on the other side of that plateau. And this is, again, is a recipe for conflict. And conflicts about water and possibly other resources are likely to become more severe in the future.
Well, just in closing, John Bongaerts, it sounds like global warming is a huge factor in this. And if the oceans rise as is predicted, lots of countries like Bangladesh will be underwater. There'll be massive population shifts, presumably. I mean, how much is global warming going to affect these figures that the United Nations demographers have just come up with?
Well, the UN has had debate about this, and for now they have argued that the impact of global warming on population growth will be fairly small, so they don't make an explicit account of this fact. But it's clear that if the sea level will rise, that populations in low-leveling areas in Egypt and Bangladesh and other places will have to move somewhere else. So it will have an impact on migration for sure. It also will increase the average temperature increase in the tropics will lead to problems with food production. On the other hand, you may be able to grow more wheat and other foodstuffs in Canada and in Siberia. So this will lead to a global imbalance. It may not be that the world as a whole will produce less food, at least not for the next few decades. But food will be grown in Canada, and there will be less food in the poorest countries. And that, again, will lead to an increase in quality among nations. But no question that population growth together with this global warming will make life more difficult, particularly for the poorest of the world.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Bongaerts.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with John Bongaerts, who's Vice President and Distinguished Scholar of the Population Council, an international nonprofit that studies world population. He focuses on fertility, population, environmental relationships, the demographic impacts of AIDS, population aging, and population policy options in the developing world. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.